You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die. The literary work of Howard Phillips Lovecraft is dark and macabre. It casts a long shadow in American literature, influencing such writers as Rod Serling, Stephen King, Bob Howard, Robert Bloch, and many others. In his stories, he wove a tapestry of mad alien gods and unspeakable horrors, and of the insignificance of man, and of a mountainous evil that sleeps in the ocean, worshipped by mad cults in dark places, known only as Cthulhu.
Actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk, Special Literary Edition.
Hello, I'm Blake Smith, the producer and co-host of Monster Talk. Today we're going to flex our leathery wings and fly off into some new territory. Traditionally on Monster Talk, I and my co-hosts, Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno, discuss monsters that are part of folklore and legend. But today, we're going to talk about monsters created by writer H.P. Lovecraft. Lovecraft was not well known in his lifetime, but his influence grew strong, and in recent years, he attained a great deal of posthumous fame. His work is cerebral and literate. His erudition found no stricture in the pulps where he was published, and to approach his tales without a dictionary would be foolhardy for most. Yet within those multisyllabular and archaic syllables lay tales of terror as visceral as those of any writer in American literature. Today on Monster Talk, we'll talk with two guests regarding Lovecraft's work. First, the well-known Lovecraft scholar, Robert M. Price, will talk with us about the writer's life and his works. And then biologist P.Z. Myers will talk with us about the biological inspiration for Lovecraft's most well-known creation, Cthulhu.
Monster Talk.
Tonight, we're interviewing Bob Price, a scholar of religion, a member of the Jesus Seminar, a teacher, a regular host of the Point of Inquiry podcast, and a noted scholar of H.P. Lovecraft and his works. And so those are kind of what's the word? They're different different specialties that you have there. The Lovecraft stuff seems somewhat at odds with the religious studies, maybe. But how did you become interested in the works of H.P. Lovecraft?
Well, I guess this was back in about 66 or 67, and Lancer Books had just I guess, done their second printing of the two Lovecraft collections, The Color Out of Space and The Dunwich Horror. And I was in the midst of just bathing in all this great pulp revival in the paperback books, plus new stuff like Tolkien being offered. And I was reading Robert E. Howard and Doc Savage and Lynn Carter and you name it. And then a friend suggested I would really like this. And so I did immediately. And I loved the Poe-esque style. And the more the Cthulhu mythology business unfolded in the writings of Lovecraft and his buddies, the more intriguing it got. And so I was deeply into conservative Christianity at the time, I was into theology, and eventually I got a doctorate in theology and another in New Testament. Well, the same interests made this very interesting to me too, because here was Lovecraft fabricating a myth system and doing it in texts that required interpretation. So this is the perfect sort of hobby for me, and I've always been really equally interested in the writing itself and in the mythology of Lovecraft. So it's been a seamless thing, actually. With now, of course, I understand it all to be mythology and such, so it's even closer. But I think I always was in touch with the deeply mythological character of all that. And another favorite interest of mine, superhero comic books. That's raw mythology also, and I love all that stuff.
Now, I come from a very conservative religious background myself, and it's been an interesting transition into a more, I guess the polite thing would just to say liberal view. Mm. Did you find that when you were reading Lovecraft's or even Robert E. Howard or that sort of thing, did you feel like you were doing something a bit profane? Did you have to cover the book up if you were at school, or, you know, the covers are kind of lurid sometimes on those books?
Well, I seem to remember feeling occasionally that there might be some incompatibility, but on the whole, I don't believe I did. But there was a time when I just felt like I needed to drop everything else away for a few years. But and I was really into witnessing and the whole thing, and I got into InterVarsity Christian Fellowship when I was in college, and I was then, instead of out-and-out fantasy writers, I was reading theologians and such, and just loved that. I'm glad I did. But once I decided I just didn't see the cogency of Orthodox religion anymore, I decided I would take a second look at these old things that had always charmed me and got back into them as well.
So, Bob, who was H.P. Lovecraft, and how did a writer who's so little recognized by modern readers come to be so well respected by modern writers?
Well, he was a proverbial pulp writer. He began just writing for himself. He had read a lot of 18th century literature because he lived in his grandfather's house. Just read the old books in the library, poetry and prose, cover to cover, top to bottom. And though he never finished high school, he was self-educated and deeply so. And he wrote for his own amusement. And when somebody persuaded him to submit a couple of stories to the new magazine Weird Tales, he did so with the letter to the editor saying, "Now, if you publish these, I don't want a single comma changed. Are you willing to do that?" And so the editor kind of laughed, we're told, and said, "Sure," and I guess kept his promise. And then Lovecraft, for years thereafter, would curse himself for compromising his aesthetic standards to appeal to the audience of the pulps, which he graciously referred to as yaps and nitwits. And yet he claimed he didn't want to commercialize or alternatively would lament that he couldn't, unlike some of his friends like August Derleth, who was a chameleon and could do either one. Well, he was very, very popular with these young readers in his time. He didn't have to wait for recognition there, though he never made much money out of it. He couldn't get a book of his stories published during his lifetime, though he came close a couple of times. And then there have been, of course, since his death, and the preservation of his work in hardcover by a couple of his pals, August Derleth and Donald Wandry, who founded Arkham House expressly for that purpose. He's attracted more and more of a cult, though Edmund Wilson was already denouncing the Lovecraft cult in the 40s, I guess it was. But it's just continued to grow. And thanks to the work, I would say mainly, of S.T. Joshi, whom I interviewed recently on our Point of Inquiry show, he has become recognized more and more in the literary mainstream. Whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know. I guess it is. But writers, as you say, have always realized this guy's pivotal importance and great gifts and have been influenced by him even when they don't want to admit it, and though many do. And now you've got the critical mainstream taking a second look at him, and whole new audiences of young readers who come to him through role-playing games and the like. They know all about his mythology before they've ever even read one of his stories. And some people come to him through the ever-increasing number of Lovecraft-based movies, and there's Lovecraftian rock, and then there are plush Lovecraft monster toys of cuddly Cthulhu and so on. So it's this flood of popular interest in Lovecraft that would have completely astounded him had he lived to see it.
We talked some about the people who were influenced by him. What about some of his predecessors, such as Edgar Allan Poe? Obviously, Poe plays a big role in Lovecraftian fiction, but what are some of the other lesser-known influences you see in his work?
Well, he loved M.R. James, the greatest ghost story writer in the English language, and he's somewhat like him, though it's hard to see specific influence other than a few ideas in particular. I don't think the mood or the style is very close to James, but Count Magnus, for instance, is a big influence on The Call of Cthulhu, as is Lord Dunsany's house in Go-By Street. And a lot of things figured in there. Lovecraft seems to have gotten a lot of his notion of the cosmic outsideness, this mystery impinging upon our own, from Algernon Blackwood. And he said that probably the greatest supernatural story was The Willows by Blackwood. And he also liked The Wendigo. Then he thought the world of Arthur Machen, who is, I think, possibly the biggest influence on him. Once you've read The White People, The Great God Pan, and one or two others by Machen, you've almost read the Dunwich Horror already. And so he's a major influence, especially the idea of the Old Ones, a surviving banished race from elder times. He got that, I think, from Machen, though he interpreted it as a pantheon of unknown gods and picked that up from Lord Dunsany, the Irish baron and fantasist. And in some ways, Dunsany and Poe have always been considered the chief influences on him, because his earliest work was very much in the classical, almost biblical style of Lord Dunsany, though he came upon it independently, and he'd already written The White Ship, considered a Dunsanian tale, before he encountered Dunsany's work, but then went whole hog for a while in that vein. But Poe really claimed him. He referred to Poe as my god of fiction. But I would say Machen was at least as much of an influence. Edgar Rice Burroughs, oddly enough, is a big influence on him, as well as John Taine, the science fiction writer. And yet I find that having gotten into these other authors, and of course – come to appreciate them greatly when I go back and read Lovecraft and see what he's done. He did successfully just what you always hear writers ought to do, to assimilate influences and make them into something new by kind of artistic alchemy. He sure did that.
So most of the people, about mid-late 1800s?
Mackin and Blackwood, and I believe M.R. James, were contemporaries of his. Okay. Blackwood read The Rats in the Walls and said that it was good, but a little too grossly physical in its horror. And I don't know if Lovecraft ever knew that, that he had commented on it. But so most of these guys were late 19th, early 20th century. Except for Poe, obviously. But he saw Dunsany do a reading in person, for instance. So he's the only one he met, I believe, out of this bunch. But they were pretty much contemporaries.
Lovecraft was a remarkable letter writer and correspondent. Was it a conscious decision on his part to build that shared fictional reality that he and other writers could place their works in?
He didn't initiate the idea, as far as I know, but once his friends began to copy him and say, oh, well, I like the Necronomicon, so I've come up with my own Book of Ibon. Oh, he loved that, as you can tell from his letters. And they said, oh, yeah, by all means. In fact, I may refer to your thing. And if some, like young Robert Bloch said, here's the story with my grimoire, The Mysteries of the Worm, Lovecraft would say, well, that's good, but let's pep it up a little bit with a Latin title. As the original, how about De Vermis Mysterious? And he would really get involved, and Richard C. writes the Eltdown Shards. Oh, he loved that. And so he set about making up this long background story, little realizing that C. Wright was working on his own in another story he hadn't shown Lovecraft yet. And so we have two completely different accountings of that. Well, he loved the game once somebody started playing it. And he liked the fact that it would grow up with all these citations, especially insofar as they were somewhat inconsistent, because that apes the character of real mythology. It's not all a neat system. So he just loved it. There are some of his fans that say this was a big mistake. Like, if I'm not mistaken, Will Murray and David Schultz and others, who are great, great Lovecraft scholars, think that this made Lovecraft make kind of a joke of it in some ways, and he probably should never have yielded to it. But the result was this irresistibly fascinating pseudo-religion that many Lovecraft fans find this to be the favorite thing of theirs, their favorite aspect of his work, the Cthulhu mythos, so-called.
And I was going to move on to Cthulhu. What is the Cthulhu mythos?
Well, it's August Derleth's pretty good attempt at coming up with a title for this. Lovecraft himself called it, tongue-in-cheek, Yog-Sothothery, as if it were a religion. And he said, well, Judaism and Christianity are no more valid than my own Yog-Sothothery. And he set up this system of myths whereby there were ancient races unknown to most people, who of beings that had come to the earth from unimaginable distances of outer space or other dimensions. Witness the creation or the evolution of humanity, or in some stories, created human beings as a mistake or a joke, as he has someone say in At the Mountains of Madness. And it was all science fiction, basically, but he has the poor, hapless, ignorant humans in certain esoteric, degraded cults doing the bidding of these ancient beings, now shut away in caverns and so on, communicating by dreams. And these people are the dregs of society, are trying to do what they can to release their masters to pillage the earth and so forth, or to drag it off into a different dimension, as it says in the Dunwich Horror. And so that they're the evil, but really just sort of stupid and venial humans trying to end the world as we know it and restore the rule of beings who are indifferent to humanity. And the big horror of this is not just, well, there's King Kong throwing the subway cars around and swatting the biplanes off the Empire State Building, physical destruction. You almost don't see that happen in his stories. One or two cases you do. But the shocking humbling of the sense of human self-importance. What you mean there were millions of years ago intelligent cephalopods and sea cucumbers with wings who were vastly superior to our intelligence now? We're the beasts, not them. And that's the really a terrible, humbling insight that he communicates, though this seems to be allegorical for Lovecraft's worldview. Of course, he didn't believe there were monsters and such, but he said the very indifference of the universe, this is the humbling and shocking truth that science tells us that people don't want to hear, so they retreat into religion and superstition. So it was a kind of a philosophy that he really did believe, using the image, the vehicle of science fiction and a kind of a hoax version of religion as priestcraft. And that's where the mythos comes in. It's gods and scriptures, but even in his own stories, it's only the duped fools who think so. So it's a really interesting combination of all these insights.
Yeah, it seemed to me that the mythos itself embodied a kind of cosmic nihilism.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's also informed by the science that was coming out at the time. Am I right in remembering, was he an amateur astronomer?
Yeah, when he was a little kid, he was in the observatory and looking out at the heavens, and he even hectographed, I think, a little Providence Journal of Astronomy and sold it. The kid was a phenomenon, and he just was absorbed in the vastness of the cosmos. And I'm sure that was a big influence on his whole outlook.
Cthulhu mythos reminds me of something else. Do you see any parallels between Lovecraft and, for example, L. Ron Hubbard with cults and alien gods and intelligences?
Well, from the little I know about the Scientology mythology, it comes out of more properly called pulp science fiction with the space tyrant and all that stuff. Lovecraft, that would be more like the aspect of Burroughs that Lovecraft didn't care for. Scientology sounds like it's based on space opera, much like the Nation of Islam with the mother plane ship up in the sky and the evil Dr. Yakub mutating specimens till he got to the blue-eyed white devil. Just sort of Saturday afternoon matinee stuff. As I understand it, Hubbard took a plausible technique of consciousness raising, the Dianetics thing, and then added this mythology to it to make it into Scientology. And Lovecraft would never have taught a doctrine like that or a method or anything. He thought people were generally all right as they were, and religion had a kind of an aesthetic value and to some degree a social control value. But he met Hubbard once, by the way, but as far as I know, his only comment was on his brilliant red hair. But I don't see a whole lot, because I think it's Lovecraft didn't, his vision, his resulting mythology wasn't as trite.
And I suppose also that Hubbard, that unlike Hubbard, Lovecraft didn't really expect people to take it seriously.
He was highly amused when they did.
Right. Yeah. So he assumed his readers were smart enough to know this is just fiction.
But sometimes they weren't. In fact, a collaborator of his, William Lumley, no relation to the great Brian Lumley today, he was a pal of Lovecraft. He collaborated with him sometime. He would sort of laughingly say in letters to other people, well, old Bill maintains that Smith and Howard and Long and I are really unwitting mouthpieces for elder entities, and that Cthulhu, etc., really exist. And so it was already starting then. People would write to him and say, where can I get a copy of the Necronomicon? And he would write back and say, I hate to tell you this, but I made it up. There's no such thing. So it began immediately that people thought it must be real, and he had to try to disabuse them.
I actually saw, I believe in the 70s, there was a black-covered book that was called the Necronomicon. I think it was a hoax of some sort.
Oh, yeah, there are a few of those. Yeah,
and I saw that before I ever read Lovecraft. And so when I first read Lovecraft, I thought, well, that's odd. I've heard of this book before. I got it all out of order. So,
was it a big – did the book look kind of like a high school yearbook?
No, this was actually the paperback. And it was in sort of the occult section of the bookstore. This was, you know, this would have been in the probably the late 70s. And I really wasn't supposed to be in that section because they had the Satanic Bible and they had this other stuff. And so over here with the occult stuff was a book called The Necronomicon. And it claimed to be, you know, the writings of Abdullah al-Dredd. But later on, I had heard that was actually a literary hoax of a sort. I mean, obviously, it wasn't the real Necronomicon because, as you say, Lovecraft made it up. So I'm not really – I'll look into that and see if I can find the history of that book. That particular one.
It's probably Simon's Necronomicon. This guy claimed to be a defrocked Eastern monk or something and called himself Simon. And what he did basically, it was published by Schlangecroft Barnes, I think it was, as a kind of a thing that looked like a big high school yearbook. And then eventually Avon, who published the Satanic Bible, published a paperback edition of this that you still see. And I'm pretty sure that's the one. And in it, he claims this is the real Necronomicon, but it is real ancient text, but it's part of some ancient Sumerian chants with a few mythos names thrown in. It is a hoax, though. And I one afternoon years ago, Lynn Carter, S.T. Joshi, and I went to the Magical Child occult bookstore in the village. And Simon was lecturing in the back room. These kids were there saying, can you use the Necronomicon with your scrying crystal and see the old ones? And this guy was up there saying, well, it might work, but I don't know if I'd try it. And we were just fuming, and that it was obvious this guy was just pulling Shub Nagurath's wool over their eyes and having a good time about it. But
did you say there was a publisher called Schlangecroft Barnes?
yeah, maybe that's the most horrifying part of it.
I'm still stuck on that. I'm sorry.
I know. I immediately thought, and they make great porn as well.
Yeah, they should have. Yeah, they may also have, for all I know.
So who is this Cthulhu character, and why of all of Lovecraft's creations does he rank the fame that he has?
Well, he's the star of this story, The Call of Cthulhu, which is one of the first to begin to move toward a system in that he pieces together documents about this hitherto unknown cult of Cthulhu and eventually discovers a manuscript written by a Norwegian sailor who happened to stumble upon Rillier, the non-Euclidean island in the Pacific where Great Cthulhu is imprisoned. And by this time, we know that Cthulhu is some sort of a space alien who ruled the world in the past, but he was the great high priest of the old ones who might or might not have been like him. And Lovecraft describes him as having a roughly humanoid or ape-like form, a kind of a colossal octopus head, rudimentary wings and claws. He was the high priest of the old ones, and they could only exist when the stars seen from the earth were in a situation, and when they moved from that, they would have to go into dormancy. But one day the day would come when they would be alive again on earth, and in the meantime they were served by these sort of idiot humans. But it was kept a great secret. You might find them in the Louisiana Bayou. You might find them among the Greenland Eskimos or who knows where. He threw a little theosophy into this. The undying leaders of the cult existed in the mountains of Tibet and such. Well, this sailor finds that Rillier has risen from the ocean and Great Cthulhu emerges. The stars are right, and the guy barely escapes with his life, and Cthulhu is this huge, lumbering, semi-material titan that follows him through the water. But somehow must have gone back into dormancy without explanation because the world has not ended. But here's a case where he described the thing, so it's something he didn't with all of his monsters. And since August Derleth coined the Cthulhu mythos and gave him the centrality, I guess people just liked him the best. There's, like with some of these entities, like Nyarlathotep, he's described in radically different ways, or Azathoth, the nuclear chaos, is never described. described and couldn't be. And Yog-Sothoth is pictured as a kind of, by implication, a huge mountain of eyes and gaping mouths and tentacles and so on. So Cthulhu is the only one you could really easily make toys out of or do cartoons with, and that's been done. I guess that's why. I don't really know, because there are about five or six that you could make the star of the show, but he's emerged as number one.
It seemed like in some ways he was kind of ahead of his times, for example, envisioning the extraterrestrials with amazing powers and stuff. It struck me, I don't know whether you would agree or not, but it struck me that without the horror aspect of it, it seems like some of the things some of the things that he writes about could have been written by New Agey or UFO buffs in the 70s, in terms of, you know, visiting alien intelligences and gods looking over us.
Well, some of those writers, like whatever, Powells and Bergier or something like that, who wrote The Morning of the Magicians, big book in France, translated into English, they credit Lovecraft with being a pioneer in this kind of thinking. And he did precede the Eric von Daniken ancient astronauts thing. Of course, he wasn't promoting it as a genuine theory, but he did try to make it plausible, and so that the ancient gods were really misunderstood aliens. And a lot of people, and that's not an absurd theory. I don't know how one would prove it, but it's not ridiculous. I find it even more amazing that in his phobia of non-white, non-Western, and to some degree even the female groups, factions of humanity, he was afraid that his these terms, logocentric, eurocentric, phallocentric, etc., the elite, the not quite dead white males, that their cultural dominion was about to be overthrown by the forces, as he saw them, of barbarism, superstition, and irrationality stemming from Southwestern Europe, Africa, Asia, and so on. And if you just take the pejorative vocabulary away from it, it's very much what many people think has happened or is happening. And so to some degree, his insidious cults of rat-faced mongrel hordes and all that, especially the intermarried people like the Innsmouth Deep Ones, represented the non-whites and the terrible possibility of of intermarrying between the ethnic
horror
groups. So he didn't like that. But he did see just the kind of world cultural change coming about before a lot of people were talking about it. He didn't like it, but I think he saw it pretty clearly.
I thought it didn't, but he married a Jewish woman, but, you know, he's kind of not famous. I mean, he gets a lot of negative press for his anti-Jew attitudes. I haven't actually been able to. I've heard he's written some pretty rude stuff along those lines, but, you know, except for like the horror of Red Hook, you know, some of that stuff's pretty. I don't know if it was edited down or he seems kind of vague about what it is he hates or doesn't like. I was very mixed about that. In fact, I actually ran into Julius Schwartz. I don't know if you know Julius Schwartz, but
Julius Schwartz? Yeah, I had the pleasure of meeting him once.
Yeah, he was Lovecraft's agent for at least a little while. And I asked him about it because he was like the only person I ever got to meet that actually knew Lovecraft. And he said that, you know, that all the time they'd worked together, that he'd heard about that anti-Semitic sort of attitude, but he said Lovecraft never showed it to him, and as far as he knew, the woman he had married was Jewish. So
that's right. Yeah.
It's very, very. The man's enigmatic to me.
Yeah, I think I don't want to defend him. He was definitely racist, but you're right. I mean, I don't want this to sound like, oh, some of my best friends belong to inferior races.
Right.
But he, in fact, as you say, his wife was Jewish. Sam Lovman, who Burke admired and loved and was a good friend, he was a Jew. And Lovman, years after Lovecraft's death, I think in as late as the 70s, heard about this side of Lovecraft and was just flabbergasted and said, the no good hypocritical SOB.
Right.
Which is unfortunate, but Lovecraft asked for it by the things he wrote.
I don't in any way want to be an apologist for the man. I like his work separate from that aspect of his life. I thought it was more confusing and surprising than an excuse. You know what I mean? It's just,
yeah,
really? You know, it's not exactly like the people who, you know, who are secretly gay and then work really hard to stop gays from having rights, but something like that to be vocally anti-Semitic and write anti-Semitically and yet marry and work with Jews seems really, well, it's odd.
Yeah. I guess it just means that it was just bad theorizing. Like, I know a guy who's a New Testament scholar and a scholar of Buddhism and just a compassionate, intelligent person, but he's also kind of a Holocaust revisionist. I'm not a denier exactly, but it's kind of startling to suddenly hear that. And then you just think, well, at least it doesn't seem to permeate the rest of him. Or it's like finding out Heidegger was a Nazi. He didn't, as far as I know, he didn't remain one when he was writing his famous philosophy, and I don't see how it taints the philosophy, or Gogarten, one of the big dialectical theologians, another Nazi. There's a few of those guys, Islamic specialists, biblical scholars who were Zieg Heiling. You know, maybe they're in hell now, but I don't see how it spoils what they wrote, since they didn't actually write about that crap. And I'd say the same with Lovecraft. He just, unfortunately, had these stupid ideas on some things.
Yeah, the racism especially, it seems to, it's intellectual laziness in my mind is what the basis of it is. You know, using race as an excuse for whatever you're concerned with. But it seems, you know, that it's hard to get around it from that era. It's a little, in a lot of stuff. But I do like his writing, you know. Whereas when we're talking about fiction, but let me get back to some of this deeper questions. Here's one for you, Bob. You're a famous person for your atheism, and you're also a well-known Lovecraft scholar. And S.T. Joshi is famous for his Lovecraft scholarship, but is also a well-known atheist. And you're kind of like bookends that way. Is this a coincidence, or does Lovecraft scholarship tend ones toward disbelief?
I think it's part of a larger picture where, though I couldn't prove this, I suspect that a huge majority of fantasy and science fiction and horror buffs are atheists or agnostics. As Lovecraft himself said, that the idea of the fantastic is especially powerful since they don't believe in it, and it would require a big imaginative suspension of disbelief, and that's what they want to do when they're reading fiction. Also, though, I think that the natural hunger people have for transcendence of the mundane either comes to them through religion or through what they know to be fantasy.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Somebody once asked Tolkien why he wrote so-called escapist fiction. And he said, well, I don't see why we should require the prisoner to think of nothing but his four walls all day. And so, you know, you do need a horizon of fantasy. And that's what all meaning is, in my opinion. We have larger brains than the animals. They have an instinctive environment that they inherit. In many ways, we have to create one, a cognitive atmosphere and habitat. And depending on what word you want to use, that is what leads us to create culture, mythology, and symbolism, and all of which give meaning, and to weave stories, which we then take as models to live by. And so I think meaning is fiction. Fiction is meaning. I like Jung. wrong when he says that, that hardwired into the brain are certain images that are presented to the consciousness in the form of religious symbols, magical symbols, fairy tales, myths, mandalas, and so on. There may not be any supernatural thing to correspond to it. I don't think there is, but we do need to connect with these fantastic archetypes of the unconscious to be able to flourish as individuals. And I think atheists find this through fantasy or fiction. Other people find it through religion. Some find it through both. So I think that's the larger connection. I asked ST the other day if he was influenced much by Lovecraft toward atheism. But he said, no, he had never really been a believer. He was not raised with any religion, where I was just the opposite. But my problem was I just came through critical study of the history and texts of religions to believe that there was not a credible case for these miraculous things having happened, and that probably God was a human creation, albeit a noble one. So I'm not like an anti-religionist like a lot of my atheist buddies. I love religion. I just don't believe that it's true in a factual sense.
And I was going to ask you, what were Lovecraft's views on religion?
Well, he thought it hung on because people needed assurance, and they felt properly threatened by meaninglessness in an empty cosmos, so they'd rather not think that it was empty. It is helpful for social control, and depending on the kind of religion you're in, it does have aesthetic satisfactions. And so he didn't think that it would be better if there were no religion, but he thought intelligent, thoughtful people would rise beyond the need, and that he had.
Bob, I was trying to think of where the first place I actually remember seeing a clear film reference to Lovecraft, and I think it was probably in Evil Dead with the book and everything. What are some of your favorite film references to his work?
I like the sort of oblique tip of the hat in The Ninth Gate with this grimoire, the Delomelanicon, the black book written by Satan himself. That's kind of Lovecraftian, with that beating to death the familiar names and such. I like the
John Carpenter's The Thing, or the
oh, well, that too, yeah, and I think that's great and very Lovecraftian.
Oh, were you going with The Mouth of Madness?
Yeah, that's the one I was trying to think of. Both of them, one explicitly, one implicitly Lovecraft. Of course, the Thing is based on the Campbell story, but many think that was based on Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. Anyhow, but it's certainly the same sort of stuff. I like that a lot. I have a great. Oh, I think this movie done by so-called amateurs a few years ago called Cthulhu, based on The Shadow Over Innsmouth, is very, very good. I have a fondness for these old clinkers like The Dunwich Horror and Die Monster Die and The Haunted Palace. They're great, cheesy moments in all of those. Mr. Ward, have you ever heard of the Necronomicon? And they're actually more Lovecraftian than the original story, so I got a huge kick out of those. There are others like the Resurrected, and a serious attempt to do Charles Dexter Ward in the modern world. I thought that was not very interesting. Or The Curse, based on the Color Out of Space. I didn't care much for that either. Or this recent one, the Dunwich Horror with Jeffrey Combs as Wilbur Whately. I thought that was awful, though not nearly as bad as Beyond the Dunwich Horror, this sickeningly terrible amateur work we screened up at the Lovecraft Film Festival. So I'm kind of picky. The more I see of Lovecraft-related movies, the more I am no longer eager to have a good one. Though I think there is still a chance. Del Toro says he wants to make At the Mountains of Madness, and if he ever gets around to it, that will be a great Lovecraft movie. But having seen all these things, I kind of feel like, let me just read the original stories. What the heck? But keep up the attempts. I hope somebody does make a real good one.
Well, I tried to do, just as a personal writing exercise, to try to do a screenplay of The Whisper in the Darkness. Mm. And it's hard, because when you take a story apart, especially Lovecraft's work, it seems that sometimes the story in your mind after having read it is is flows much more smoothly than the actual words on the page. Especially that one. I mean, so much of the action is actually happening in letters already in the past. It's almost like a, you know, Kafka, or it's like the Metamorphosis. Where the action's already happened, you know, everything's already taken place, and you're just left with the horror, you know, which doesn't really work on screen very well.
Almost everything is off stage. Like you say, the letters, what are you going to do with that? But also when Wilmarth is in the house and he wakes up and hears these voices and realizes, I got to get the hell out of here. Even there, you don't see what's happening. And of course, if you did, it would ruin it. So there's not that much to see. And the biggest sequence would be this guy driving through the hills of Vermont, which would look nice, but you couldn't even do that for very long. And it's very tough, so they always have to add in the things Lovecraft carefully omitted, like characterization and action. So what do you got left? And that is tough.
Yeah, it's been tough for me as a fan. You know, I don't want to be a snob about the movies, but it really is. So the movies that seem to work best for me are, like you say, The Ninth Gate, I thought did a very nice job, and I love The Thing. These movies that are influenced by, but not necessarily directly derived from, Lovecraft's work. So,
Lovecraft's he never quite got away from the idea of prose poetry, which he learned from Dunsany, and even his scientifically technical prose works in like At the Mountains of Madness and The Shadow Out of Time, even they're artfully crafted in such a way that so much depends on the narration, not the story, that the whole experience is almost more like reading poetry than fiction. And that, you know, good luck making a movie out of a poem. Look at the horrible attempt of making The Raven. Oh, brother.
Well, you know, I thought Night Gallery did a few nice pieces. I don't know if you've seen those.
I have, but I don't remember them well enough anymore to say.
They did Cool Air, and they did the Pickman's Model, and you know, for the time, I think they did a good job.
I do remember those being pretty good.
Yeah. Anyway, famous game designer Sandy Peterson designed a very influential role-playing game called Call of Cthulhu, which is how most of the people I know actually became introduced to Lovecraft's work. Have you actually played those games, or have you seen that game or looked into it at all?
I played it once or twice. I know I played it once because my wife and I got together with Chris Henderson, the great detective mystery writer, and Gahan Wilson, the cartoonist, and played a game of it, which Gahan then reported on in the Twilight Zone magazine. And thereafter, people would some people thought I must be a great aficionado of this game. I tried it that time. I just do not care for that kind of thing. I mean, you know, all honor to those who like it, but I just would rather, if I'm going to be plotting stuff out, I'd rather just write it down as a story.
Makes sense.
But you're right. You know, I owe a great deal to this, though, because I only did all those Chaosium anthologies because I believe it was the late Keith Herber came up with the idea that they had all these minions of Lovecraft gamers that wanted to know where all this stuff came from, and a lot of the fiction wasn't even in print anymore. And so we did these thematic anthologies that you want to know who Yog-Sothoth is. Okay, here's the documentation. You can study the concept from the stories that influenced it to the ones Lovecraft has it in and the ones others have done. And so it helped bring some of the gamers into the fold, and then some of them began to get into the literary side of it and dump the gaming. Interesting how it evolves.
Well, Bob, here's a final question that we like to ask all of our guests. What's your favorite monster?
Ooh, that's tough. I guess I would probably say the Frankenstein monster.
All right. Any particular reason why?
always striking in appearance and as a character, terrifying and sympathetic, monstrous and childlike, almost a Christ figure. I love all these old movies he's in, though I love all the Universal monsters, but I guess he's really the archetypal one.
The alien god Cthulhu is depicted as a cephalopod head set atop a ponderous humanoid body replete with enormous wings. Implausible, but in the context of Lovecraft's fiction, its alien weirdness is horrifically evocative. We now talk to biologist P.Z. Myers about the biology of actual cephalopods and their weird, alien, but real bodies. After all, it wouldn't be Monster Talk if we didn't sprinkle some science on our big bowl of horror.
Monster Talk.
So you're P.Z. Myers, and you're famous for your blog, Pharyngula. You're famous for your atheism. But I understand that you also are an evolutionary biologist, and you specialize in octopuses?
Not exactly. I'm interested in evolution and development. Most of my work is actually done on a chordate. I work on zebrafish. But cephalopods are especially interesting if less well studied because they represent such a radically different body plan from what we're familiar with. So there's been this long-term fascination with them.
That's interesting. I watch a lot of science fiction movies, and I think for expediency, people tend to create monsters that are anthropic. Mm-hmm. It's easier to put a guy in a suit if the suit looks something like a human.
Yeah, bumpy foreheads and things like that, yeah.
But the body type of... what's the right word here? I'm not sure what to call them. You know, so there's octopus, there's squid, there's cuttlefish.
They're all cephalopods.
They're all cephalopods. So if you're talking about them as a group, do you say cephalopods, cephalopodia? What's the right way to say that?
Well, you know, if you're pedantic, you say cephalopodia. If you're just...
Well, we're very pedantic.
Well, darn, I prefer cephalopods, but...
We can say cephalopods, but I want our listeners to know that we understand cephalopodia is the right word. So that's cool.
So, PZ, how did a person who has an interest in aquatic creatures end up in Minnesota?
Yeah, I'm about as far from the oceans as you can possibly be, but... No, it's simple academic realities that there are a limited number of jobs out there for people of my persuasion, you know, weird developmental biologists, and so you take them where you can get them. And I happen to be at a very nice school, a very good school, which has got a very strong student body, and it's the kind of place I wanted to work. So even though I'm far from the oceans, the student body makes it worthwhile.
I understand you've got to go where the jobs are. Fortunately, language is everywhere for me.
Well, you know, the animal I work on in the lab is a zebrafish, which you can raise in a tank anywhere. So, you know, that's very portable. And then I get to travel a lot, and I get to see these cephalopods wherever I go.
Did you pick zebrafish for any particular reason?
I did my thesis on them. I picked them way back in the early 1980s when they were just starting to take off as an experimental animal. I was in a lab at the University of Oregon, which was doing research on them. And the main appeal was, I'm interested in the development of the nervous system. How do you make a nervous system function? All this kind of cool stuff. And we started looking for organisms that have very simple nervous systems because simple is easier. And then we realized, hey, you know, if you look at really young animals, the younger you get, the smaller the nervous system is, and the more and more manageable it becomes. And zebrafish just happen to develop really, really rapidly, and they're transparent, so you can see right into the skull and all kinds of cool stuff like that. So it made it very easy to study the nervous system.
Would you call them the fruit fly of the aquarium?
Yeah, the fruit fly of the freshwater aquarium, sure, yeah.
So what are you doing with them? I mean, this is way off topic from Cthulhu, but...
Maybe not so far off topic, because the kind of work I do right now is teratogenesis. I make monsters in the lab using various agents.
Cool.
Yeah.
We had a recent guest that did the same thing with chickens.
And what did they use?
You mean, what did they use to make the monsters?
Yeah.
You know, he just said agents. He didn't say what he was doing. He said that there were different things they were doing. But
it was all classified.
Yeah, it's all top secret stuff.
Okay.
Mustard and secret herbs and spices is what I use in my chicken. So.
so that's where that new KFC sandwich came from.
Right. Yeah, that's a monster. Yeah.
Yes, that's indeed.
All right, so let's talk about Cthulhu for just a moment. So in H.P. Lovecraft's work, he's got this giant creature that essentially has an octopus for a head. It has somewhat anthropic body with wings. It's not really clear if it – I guess it flies through space. I'm not sure. But it's really big, so big that he describes it as a mountain walked or stumbled. That's how big it is. Huge, huge. Okay. But in real life, you know, sea creatures don't get as big as that. But octopus and squid do get pretty large. How big are these creatures? How big are they getting to these days?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to remember some of the numbers offhand. The giant octopus can easily get up to, you know, 6 to 8 foot span of tentacles. And so you find those quite common. So they're pretty good size. They can wrestle with a person. Giant squid, of course, even bigger, many meters long, but unfortunately, contrary to most of the reputation, they're pretty placid animals. They're deep sea creatures. They tend to live in environments that aren't rich in resources, and so they tend to be kind of sluggish and soft and gooey. Tasty for a sperm whale, I'm sure, but no, they're not quite the monsters they're made out to be.
And I hear that cephalopods are the most intelligent octopi. Octopuses? Octopi? What's the plural to begin with?
Octopuses.
Octopuses. I hear that they're the most intelligent of all invertebrates. So how smart are these animals? Because I've seen experiments where they've opened jars to get to food.
Oh, yeah. They can unscrew jars. They can do all kinds of things. They can remember things. They will cache things around their tanks and remember where they are. They can pass various kinds of memory tests. They recognize people, and they will respond to people on the other side of the tank. They're escape artists. They get all kinds of talents. They do some spectacularly clever things, and then the surprising thing is that their brain is very tiny. This we don't understand yet.
Is there a relationship between their size and their intelligence at all?
Well, what do you mean a relationship? It's like with vertebrates. There doesn't seem to be much of a relationship. You can look at a gray whale, or you can look at a human being. A gray whale has a brain that's two or three times larger than ours, but I don't think they're as smart as we are. Unless it's just that they're keeping quiet. Yeah, but there's a really poor correlation there. And in particular, when you look at something like an octopus. Their brain is a small ganglion that's basically wrapped around their esophagus. And when you look at it, it's got a relatively small number of neurons, you know, compared to ours, but you know, still a reasonable number. So it seems like they're doing a lot with very little. Impressive stuff.
Wow. Hmm. Their brain's wrapped around their esophagus.
That's incredible.
Yes. Yeah. Most invertebrates have a ventral nerve cord. So, you know, we have a dorsal nerve, spinal cord that goes up down our back. Their nervous system tends to run down the ventral side, right there where the esophagus is also located. And the primary ganglion is actually wrapped around, which is kind of neat, too. When they eat, you know, when they chew up a big chunk of something and pass it through their throat, it's actually compressing the brain a bit.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that surprising. I mean, I think part of my brain's in my stomach and parts in my pants based on my food. So distributed brains, yeah.
So does it affect them to eat then? Does it affect their brain?
I don't know. You'd think it would. You know, if you do something to put pressure on the brain, you can get responses. These kinds of cognitive responses and visual hallucinations and so forth. So, you know, I always imagine when an octopus is eating, it's seeing stars as things flash by its throat. But we don't know.
They also have spectacular eyes, too, don't they?
So. They have very good eyes, yeah. Large eyes, they're very visual sorts of animals. In a lot of ways, the eyes are better than ours. They're not inside out like ours are, for instance.
So do they see the same way we do, or is it somewhat different?
It's somewhat different. I mean, the general plan of the eyeball is very similar in that they've got collections of photoreceptor cells, just like we do. They have a retina. They have a distributed nerve net that's leaving the eyeball at the back, so there's no single optic nerve. The photoreceptors are in the front instead of the back, like they are in us. Visual processing, they've got ganglia that handle a lot of the brain power of figuring out what the visual world is saying. That's separate from the subesophageal ganglion, for instance. So, they're fairly sophisticated. They can do a lot with their eyes.
Now, a lot of them change color. So is it safe to assume they can also see color?
Yes, they can. So they've got lots and lots of photoreceptors. They have very good color vision. Well, I should say, you have good color vision for them, but often what you find is color vision in aquatic animals is tuned for the environment. Because the water filters light in particular ways, you find a different distribution of photoreceptors than you would in us.
Do they see in the same spectrum as we do, or is it shifted, or do you know?
I'm not sure. It's probably shifted a little bit, but not much. That 400 to 800 nanometer range that we use is pretty universal.
Now, did they start off in the water from an evolutionary perspective?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. Just like we did. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. All animals started out, their distant ancestors all evolved in the ocean many hundreds of millions of years ago. So, yeah. They arose from creatures that were probably more slug-like. Most of what we regard as unique to the cephalopods, that big ruff of tentacles and so forth, all is a modified foot. So you have to kind of imagine a slug, and just the base of that slug gets expanded and branches into tentacles. And that becomes the tentacle end of the animal. And then that big head that you see back there, that's actually not a head. That's a big bag of guts. That's where its abdomen and its intestines and all that kind of stuff are located.
Wow.
The creationists don't want to hear that.
Well, the creationists don't want to hear it.
I don't think I wanted to hear this kind of grass.
Yeah, well, have you ever cleaned them? I mean, if you work with squid or octopus for dinner sometime and you've got to clean them, that big head part, the mantle part, is basically a bag of guts, and you just have to scoop everything out of there and throw it away.
Wow, so do you eat the, what is that called? The
calamari.
The mantle? Oh, I know that.
The food version.
I was thinking the head of the squid was called, I think it was called the mantle, if I remember correctly.
Right. But,
Do you eat that part too? I thought it was just the legs we were eating.
We eat calamari. It's rings, and basically what that is the mantle, which is a hollow tube, which has been sliced up into rings.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you eat them?
Yeah. Do I eat?
No, just PZ.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Sure. I love them. They're delicious.
Yeah. They're great breaded with salt and pepper. I think that's deep fry. We fry everything in the South. They sell fried pickles down here. They sell everything's fried. So,
I know.
Sweet tea and fried pickles.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
What's the relationship between the squid, the octopus, and the cuttlefish? Like, is one of them more like a recent development than the others, or are they just kind of brand? I mean, what drove those evolutionary changes? Do you think?
Oh well. They have different lifestyles for what I mean. An octopus, most octopus are benthic animals. That means they live at the bottom. They cling to the shores. They live in the bottom of the rocks and the weeds and things like that. Squid tend to be deep water, pelagic, and they're specialized for swimming. Although, of course, there are variations. There's some squid that hover down in the bottom and dig into the sand for food. But, yeah, basically there was a big split many hundreds of millions of years ago, largely into the eight-armed octopuses and the ten-armed squid. The ten-armed condition is primitive, and so octopus are derived. They're the specialized form that arose later.
So do the really large squid and giant octopuses, do they use ink?
Yes. It's a very common trait that they have.
And I understand that some versions, I guess even one of the most toxic animals in the world is actually an octopus. I think it's the blue ring.
But their skin contains various toxins, in particular neurotoxins. That's why they're so lethal. They go right to your nervous system and fry things.
So is that normal for octopus, or is that just specialized for that one species?
It's fairly common among invertebrates, actually. Lots of them produce this thing, you know, for instance, tetrodotoxin, which is a common nerve poison that they make. It's rare for them to make it in such large volumes that the animal itself is entirely toxic. There are a number of cephalopods, though, that secrete quantities of these poisons right around the beak. So if they bite you, it can be quite painful. It can actually poison you that way. Many of them just trust in the fact that there's all kinds of filthy bacteria lurking there, and they can essentially induce sepsis in their target by biting into them.
Yeah, we have those in Australia. I've seen them on the beach, along with hypodermic needles and condoms.
they have a drug problem? There's a lot of drugs there.
No, I've seen them on the sand and blue bottles and things, so...
Well, at least they're using safe sex. That's the important thing.
That's right.
Australia sounds like a dangerous place. I'm not so sure I want to go there. It's like,
well, your animals scare me as well.
Yes. Oh, do they? Well, okay. Well, we'll talk about that later.
Mountain lions and bears. I always say that.
Oh, lions and tigers and bears.
And tree alligators. Yeah.
Tree alligators are a real threat, but not so much in Colorado.
Yeah.
Still haven't seen one. I don't know why.
You're not looking up. So what's the fossil record like for these creatures? It doesn't seem like much would be around.
It's not great because, of course, they're soft-bodied. There's very little that can be preserved. But, no, they found some specimens that are hundreds of millions of years old. They're rare. You've got to have really good preservation to protect something that soft-bodied from immediate decay. But, yeah, there's a few really cool fossils that have been discovered that show... Oh, the octopuses, for instance, haven't changed that much in a couple hundred million years.
So they survived the KT extinction. Interesting.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, they're aquatic. And in general, invertebrates are so profligate in producing offspring that they're really good at surviving these sorts of things.
Going back to eating these creatures, I was told that the giant squid have too much ammonia in them to be edible. Why is that?
Right. Oh, many of the squid that live in midwater, that, you know, that hover deep in the water, they use ammonia for buoyancy. So they saturate the tissues to give them a neutral buoyancy. Yeah, because it's lighter than water.
Wow.
That's basically the strategy they're following. So they're kind of inedible unless you soak them for a long time, and even then, by that time they're mush. Who wants to eat that?
So why do you think so many people are frightened of these tentacled animals?
Oh, it's the weirdness of them. It's that they look so unusual and different. That, you know, for instance, where is the face of an octopus?
I don't know.
You know,
not if its brain's wrapped around its esophagus.
Yeah. We're so used to looking at creatures, whether it's a dog or a tiger or a bear or whatever you're afraid of. But at least you can see a face. You can see there's eyes, there's a nose, there's a mouth. And we can fit them into a mental model of that's what an animal should look like. Something like a squid, you don't. You can look into it and you can see two eyes there. Then below that, there's this confusing mass of tentacles just branching everywhere. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons Lovecraft sort of seized on that imagery for his... Whereas Cthulhu is so different than what we expect. It looks pathologically weird.
And probably because of the toxicity of these creatures, too?
Well, I didn't even know about that, really, but that's just me. But
Well, coming from Australia,
oh, yeah,
I
no
certainly
doubt.
Knew about
it's
that.
Totally different, yeah.
Yeah, but everything is toxic in Australia. Like,
have you tried Foster's?
Including me.
That's funny. I
think it's just the visual impact of the animal, that it's a creature that's just organized so differently from the way we are, that you get confused, you get baffled in looking at it. And that's one of the things that Lovecraft really tried to get across in his crazy writings, is the idea of things that you cannot grasp, that you look at and you see, and they drive you mad because they're so different from everything you're used to. And I think a cephalopod fits that category pretty well.
I think so too.
Mm.
Well, one more question. What is your fascination with them? I notice you've got them as your wallpaper on Feringula. So.
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, they have such a very different body plan from ours.
Yeah.
That one of the things I'm always interested in my own work is how do you lay out the blueprint of an animal? In invertebrates, we've got a good idea that, for instance, there are these things called Hox genes that are expressed early on, and they sort of stake out the foundation of the animal. You know, they say, this is the front end, this is the back end, this is the stuff in the middle. And when you look at a cephalopod, it breaks all the rules. It's not a simple linear organism anymore. It's got this kind of a radial organization of its tentacles. So I'm really curious to know how exactly, in a molecular sense, do they set up that pattern? What kind of genes are they using to do this sort of stuff? We know some of the answers. We know that they are using the Hox genes, the same Hox genes that we use to set up pattern along the longitudinal axis.
Yeah.
They're using in a weird combinatorial scheme to set up the identities of each tentacle.
So can you make tentacles grow in different places if you change the genes around?
Well, theoretically, yeah. They've worked out the sort of Hox code for a tentacle, so you know which Hox genes are turned on for which tentacle. And if cephalopods were better experimental animals for molecular biology, and they aren't, they're really hard to raise, then theoretically, yeah, we could go in there, we could do some tinkering. Every once in a while, a cephalopod will wash up that is strange, different, and it looks like it's a mutant of some sort, and usually it's dead, so it hasn't survived. For instance, there was one a couple of years ago that was very exciting because it actually had bifurcating tentacles.
Wow.
Each tentacle branched and branched and branched. So we know there's also interesting stuff going on in the regulation of the growth.
What's the cause of that when that happens?
We don't know. That's what's kind of neat about it. In vertebrates, we know how you regulate the branching pattern that we get in our hands, forming the fingers. And again, it's Hox genes switching on particular patterns. And in these, this was just a one-off sort of thing, an odd specimen that washed up. We suspect it's probably something similar, that there's misexpression of certain genes that regulate these patterned expressions. But we don't have it as an experimental animal, so we can't do the experiments. It's kind of frustrating.
Wow.
But cool.
But yeah, very cool. Yeah, so, it's kind of funny because, not like ha-ha funny, but... we talked to Dr. Marcus Davis, who's at my local university in Kennesaw, and he was talking about some of the things they can do and what controls there are for making, genetic manipulation. And I'm torn, as a layperson, because, on the one hand, I understand you don't want to be cruel to the animals. But on the other hand, making an octopus with 24 tentacles sounds cool,
And what are the implications for humans?
Right. Hey, when can I have tentacles? Exactly, Karen. Thank you. Not enough people ask that.
That's what you were thinking.
Oh, yeah. It's also just a way to look into the fundamental aspects of organization of matter. How does life get to be this way? And so doing these kinds of experiments are essential for understanding what's going on there. Like I said, we've got these little examples like that octopus with the bifurcating tentacles. And it's so provocative. We want to know how that worked. We want to know what are the rules for branching in a tentacle.
Yeah.
And in order to figure that, you got to do experiments. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you got to.
But it's still no worse than chopping them up and eating
them. That was my thought, exactly. I mean, nothing personal against the chickens, but although you have to have these ethical sign-offs for doing the experiments, I can go to KFC and get my chicken on a chicken, you know, cheese sandwich or whatever.
Right.
So
and most of these experiments you can do in far more humane ways than even farming takes care of animals, because we're not interested in causing them harm. We're not interested so much in ripping them to pieces and putting their flesh on a plate so you can eat it. So we can do things like very carefully anesthetize, monitor. We euthanize if there's any sign of stress. So, most scientists are pretty darn ethical about this sort of thing.
Okay. Well, we have a sort of a mandatory question we ask all of our guests, and that is, what is your favorite monster?
Oh, well, gee.
So many of them.
Like a cryptozoological monster?
No, it could be anything you want it to be. I mean, the last one we had was a titmouse.
Any anomaly.
Yeah.
You just wanted to say that?
You know, I hate to say it because I don't think of it really as a monster, but Vampyrotuphus is pretty darn cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
no.
Vampyrotuphus infernalis is a deep water squid.
It's wicked cool. Yeah,
it's very creepy looking. It lives way down in the darkness. It's got these tentacles that are bridged by webbing and so forth. You have to see pictures of them to see.
I'll shoot Kieran a picture. We'll put a picture in the show notes.
Yeah.
It sounds monstrous enough to me.
The eyes, though. They don't have eyelids. Instead, the skin around the eye just kind of irises shut around them.
Wow.
And it's bizarre to see. It's just, again, so alien looking to see that.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, PZ. I appreciate it.
Oh, my
thank
pleasure.
You, PZ.
Yeah.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to this special literary edition of Monster Talk. I enjoy putting the show together, and if you enjoy listening to it, let us know. Today we heard about American cosmic horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. Our guests were Robert M. Price and P.Z. Myers. Your hosts were myself, Blake Smith, Ben Radford, and Dr. Karen Stolzno. As I put this show together, I had envisioned interviewing S.T. Joshi, the biographer of Lovecraft we mentioned during the show. However, Bob Price effectively conducted the exact interview I wanted over at Point of Inquiry. So as an adjunct to this episode, I suggest you check it out. A link is in our show notes. Also, while I was putting this together, a paper was published on the evolutionary basis for cephalopod pseudopods. The CB show Quirks and Quarks did an excellent interview with the PhD candidate Martin Smith on his findings. It's a great interview, and I've put that link in the show notes. Monster Talk is produced with the assistance of Skeptic Magazine. When the stars are right, Cthulhu will rise and destroy us all! In the meantime, why not relax and enjoy a nice read of Skeptic? You might gain 1d10 sanity. No promises on that. Music for today's episode included Monster Talk's theme by Peach Stealing Monkeys, 1000 PSI, A.R. Morgan, and now, by special permission, a snippet of a most excellent song by the Eben Brooks Band, Hey There Cthulhu.
Hey there, Cthulhu, down there in your sunken city, you're a billion light years distant, and the stars look very pretty from Relay. So close and yet so far away, E-I-E-A. Cthulhu Fatagin, or is that Cthulhu Fatine? I can never quite remember, 'cause I'm not in my right mind since I met you. No one corrupts the way you do, you know it's true. Oh, it's what you'll do to me, oh, and all humanity. Oh, you'll rise up from the sea, oh, kill everyone slowly, except the ones like me.
Hungry for more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.